cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
A woman investor of, I feel like, our decade already. And she and I have been talking for about 7 years since she started.
First interview. We were barely off the ground, and I was so grateful. So.
Well, you resonated with me, that's for sure, because you have really tapped into so many of the trends that have we're talking about today and living. I mean, I live with this thing, for instance. But you know, one of the questions I think we all want to know today is, did you buy the ProShares Bitcoin ETF?
No, we did not. Okay. And one of the reasons is we're looking at this very carefully, the futures. There are some tax ramifications we'd like to understand more, having to do with contango, which is where what contango versus more normal backwardation.
Right.
So,
not yet.
Not yet.
All right. So I said that Kathy and I have known each other for 7 years and we have been talking. When you did come on, I don't even think you had your funds launched yet.
Nope.
You talked with Pim Fox and myself on Bloomberg Radio. So let's go back, because how did you get here? I mean, my gut from just talking to you is that there was no plan to be a celebrity fund manager and someone that we print out a story every day about your comings and goings. So what was your plan?
Well, my plan was...
Because you've been in the financial industry.
Yes,
I've
been
in
the financial industry. And after the tech and telecom bust, and then even more so after 08, 09, I began to see just incredible risk aversion, career risk, business risk, and everybody was worshiping the almighty index benchmarks. And that was not consistent with what we were doing at all. So we were becoming, I describe it as an otter duck,
yeah.
You know? And I also felt this was very bad behavior. I feel like maybe investing in tried and true is not wrong, but investing only in the past, I do believe is wrong, because there are so many So there is so much in the way of innovation evolving,
right.
And I did not feel like it could be funded appropriately in the public markets. The private markets were screaming, so valuations were crazy there. The same kind of stock was selling for a fraction of the valuation in the public markets.
Right.
And so I felt there was an arbitrage opportunity. Many people in the public world said, oh, those private valuations, those are going to crash. We didn't think that was true. We thought the public market valuations were going to move up. So I felt that this focus on innovation had been lost, research lost,
right.
Investing lost in the public markets. And I said, we could fulfill a huge unmet need and change this misallocation of capital, which is all about the past, especially because of the explosive growth opportunities there are in the future.
So tell us about, and I know there's been a podcast you've done and there's been some writing, what was the aha moment
yes.
that you said, I'm going to do this differently? And I want you, if you don't mind, I mean, I know your faith is important to you, mm-hmm. and the name of your company is ARC. Mm-hmm. So how did that play into it?
Sure. So I remember walking into my home on a beautiful sun. I get these epiphanies on beautiful sunny days when I'm not really thinking about anything. But I walked into my home, beautiful sunny day, silence. Now, I had three children, two dogs, and a nanny, and it was complete silence because they were going to all be away for 2 weeks. First time ever in this house. And I walked into the kitchen, and I wasn't happy, but I wasn't sad. It was just like, whoa, this hasn't happened to me before. And I wasn't even thinking about work. And I got the message loud and clear. You have to take all of the technologies that have disrupted other industries and start to disrupt your own and focus on the new creation.
It sounds like, and I want to stay here for a moment, I have faiths and beliefs that are very important to me. It sounds like your faith guides you in a lot of ways. How does it, as you look at these companies, make your investments, make your decisions? How does that play into it, Kathy?
Well, first of all, in terms of that aha moment, you know, many people would describe that as the force or the universe. I would call it the Holy Spirit. And so the Holy Spirit as a guide, you know, as much as we in the financial world would like to think we're in control, we're not. There are much bigger forces in control.
Some would say the Fed's in control right now a little bit.
No, not even the Fed's in control. So
it sounds like, and I want to stay here for a moment, I have faiths and beliefs that are very important to me. It sounds like your faith guides you in a lot of ways. How does it, as you look at these companies, make your investments, make your decisions? How does that play into it, Kathy?
Well, first of all, in terms of that aha moment, you know, many people would describe that as the force or the universe. I would call it the Holy Spirit. And so the Holy Spirit as a guide, you know, as much as we in the financial world would like to think we're in control, we're not. There are much bigger forces in control.
Some would say the Fed's in control right now a little bit.
No, not even the Fed's in control. So, and this idea of the new creation. In fact, it was after I described what the ecosystem that I wanted to put in place involving social media and giving our research away. And, you know, I wasn't even thinking about going viral in the way that we have gone viral. I was just thinking, how can we get our message out? Because we can't get it out through traditional channels.
Right.
Nobody believes in us.
Well, if you're going to do it differently, like you're going to do it differently all the way.
All the way. And so I've forgotten your question. What was the last bit of it?
What was my last part of the question? I forgot, too. I was like caught up with you. well, what's interesting is, you know, I'm curious about, I was talking about, you know, how your faith has guided you in terms of the specific investments that you make, whether it's a Tesla, whether it's Bitcoin, whether it's, you know, a biopharma company.
Right. So we are seeking the truth as these new technologies evolve, all of them at the same time,
right,
and cause like a lot of chaos, a lot of confusion, a lot of FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt in our markets. And we're trying to allocate capital to its highest and best use, do the right thing.
How hard was it in the early days? And you essentially bootstrapped it, what, for 3 years?
Yes.
And you had people working at home, right?
No, we all worked in an office.
You all worked in an office,
forgive me.
How hard was
that
it?
That was a very important part of coming together. The bonds that we created during that time will never leave us. So how was it in the early days? We were on a mission. And, you know, I never thought we were going to fail. Many other people thought we were going to fail.
Right.
I remember Eric Balchunas is very kind in the beginning. He's very kind and
at
says,
Bloomberg follows
at
ETFs.
Bloomberg follow, yeah, he's, I think, your top ETF journalist. And he really thought we were destined for failure and basically told me so in a very nice way. But I just didn't believe that. And one of the reasons people thought we were going to fail is here, we chose a wrapper that was dominated by passive portfolios and put an active strategy in there. And people thought that was crazy. Now, after 2.5 years of no traction, effectively, I began to say, "Wow, was that a bad move?" And so we did. We started doing separately managed accounts and so forth. But it turns out that that was a great decision because so many people thought it was such an awful decision.
Right.
We had so much visibility that when we started to gain traction, when the inflows started, it was like a head fake, and you know, it got us so much more attention than we would have gotten otherwise.
I mean, what were institutional investors saying to you in the early days when you made your pitch?
Too volatile. That was the pitch. I mean, that was the response. Too volatile. We couldn't possibly do that. And here we are. We are a volatile strategy.
Right.
And our response was, well, volatility on the upside is not a bad thing.
Right.
And last year was a good example of that.
But the other thing we
said at the time, and we actually took our cues from a value investor who said to us, "I would never buy one stock in your portfolio, but I like your research and you might be right, so I'm gonna just put 5%. This is a value investor, 5% as a hedge. And as did our first institutional investor, which is value oriented,
right?
And kind of thought we were behaving like a value manager, long-term time horizon, and looking for extreme values. Well, value investors are using price to book and dividend yield and that sort of thing. We're using growth. You know, we're using spectacular growth rates that no one is expecting. And Tesla was our first proof of concept, I would say, a very visible one, where people were saying, "What are they talking about?" And all we had done was used Wright's Law, which is the centerpiece of our research, to try and figure out how quickly costs would decline in battery pack systems, and therefore how much prices would fall for electric vehicles and how quickly the uptake would be. And we saw Elon Musk magnificent things happening in terms of
costs. But it wasn't so easy to be invested in Tesla early on.
For us, it was easy.
Because you just believe the story, or?
The most important call that we made initially with Tesla was, all right, Tesla's battery technology is unlike any other auto manufacturer's battery technology. Tesla was riding down the cost curve of the consumer electronics industry. So laptops, cell phones, huge volumes, right? And when you get a scaling like that, costs come down. It's called a learning curve in the tech industry. So Elon, you had auto manufacturers and auto analysts laughing at him. Elon is building his car on top of cell phone batteries. Isn't that funny? And what they didn't believe was that the engineering was possible.
Right.
So there was a, it wasn't, they just didn't think it was possible. And he did. And so even today, these cylindrical batteries that he's been using relative to lithium ion pouch, lower cost and will remain lower cost for at least 3 years, we think, which means that any other auto manufacturer who wants the same performance and the same range at the same price will have to lose money on every car sold.
So it keeps him in a really great position.
And that's only one of four barriers to entry.
Well,
but that was the first call we had to make.
So Elon Musk and Tesla. So there is a point that you would get out. I know there's a story you've talked about. You put a mark on the stock price. I think it was 3,000?
Yeah, 3,000 is our base case. Not our bull case, but our base case.
Okay, so there is a point where you could say, okay, I'm moving on. You've gotten out of Apple.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are backward-looking companies or technologies that you don't think are, or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. They are very well understood. Their dynamics are well understood. They are the fangs.
Right.
They're well-owned. And we just want our clients to be exposed to the next fangs, which are not going to be in the fang category, but the next fangs. And Tesla Tesla's becoming a fang. You know, I think it will end up in that grouping at some point. We would sell. So our minimum hurdle rate of return expectation for a stock is 15% at an annualized rate over 5 years. So a doubling over 5 years. Tesla is about nearly a quadrupling over 5 years, so well within our range. So, you know, we have been taking profits, and that's because Tesla in here, I think it's becoming very obvious now that electric vehicles are taking massive share from traditional gas-powered vehicles. And so the stock finally is responding to that reality, because that has been true.
Had a significant bounce back.
Yes, it has. Whereas much of our portfolio has still been in a bit of a weak spot. So this is called portfolio management. That's all this is.
Well, let's talk performance, because it's been off the charts, and it was certainly last year. This year, it's been a little bit tougher. Mm-hmm. If I go last year, five of ARK 7 ETFs returned an average of 141%. Three were the top performers among all U.S. funds. We wrote the story, you were the top stock picker in 2020. This year, if we look at ARK Innovation, down around 25% from its peak in February of this year. Yeah. It's up 7% for the year. What's tougher about this year for you guys?
Well, it's not tougher. We expected it and wanted it, actually. Not that we want our stocks to go down, but what we didn't want was another bubble, which was when the market became more and more narrowly focused on just one group.
Right.
Instead, what happened, energy's up 50% this year, financials are up 30%, and oh, by the way, we think those two sectors are going to be the most disrupted of any. But what's happened is there has been a rotation into value as a style, as fears of inflation and interest rates increasing picked up. And therefore, there's been a broadening out of this bull market.
Right.
I think we are in a very strong bull market, very strong bull market. It has overcome a doubling of interest rates, long-term interest rates in the first quarter, all of this tax talk, all of this strife.
No worry that there's so much money chasing too many options? I mean,
am I worried about inflation? Is that the question?
Well,
yes.
Well, and bubbles within the market.
Not bubbles. I can tell you, the way I know that is from the nature of the questioning that we get when we go into any meeting, retail or institutional.
Right.
It's much more about risks, very little about opportunity. That's not what happens during a bubble. But inflation, now, we do have a differentiated point of view there. Art Laffer is my mentor. We did an interview with you.
We talked about it.
Yes. And so I've always had to, as part of my portfolio management perspective, I've always had to have an understanding of the economic backdrop.
You actually debated Henry Kaufman way back when.
Oh, yes.
From what I understand,
yes.
when
I was at
Jenison.
Jenison, Henry Kaufman, Al Wojnarowski, Gary Winglowski.
The original Dr. Doom.
Yeah, Doctors Doom and Gloom. No, Doctors Doom and Death. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And so, and that's where I learned about, you know, wow, if everyone is going in that direction, and back then it was inflation and interest rates are embedded in the system at a double-digit rate. This is the early 80s.
Right.
And someone dares to go the opposite way after those who had gone the opposite way had been bludgeoned with higher interest rates and higher inflation. So this was timing. There's a lot of money to be made. And that's how I felt about innovation. And that's how I still feel about it. So inflation. We expected inflation. I do these YouTube videos, and we started talking about the base effect and supply chain issues last year. I didn't expect a second round of supply chain issues where now we have people hoarding because of Christmas. That I didn't expect.
Right.
And so we're getting another round of inventory building, but not in businesses, in homes. Mm-hmm. That car they bought last year is in their driveway or their garage. Auto sales, many people don't realize this, in the US peaked in April at 18.5 million units and are now at 12. Now, that is not just chip shortages.
Yeah.
That is, I bought my car last year, I'm probably never buying another gas car again, I'm gonna wait for an electric vehicle. That's what I think is going on, or some of what's going on.
Right.
So, if we're right on that, then I think there's a lot of double and triple ordering in the system right now. This happens at the end of every cycle, and certainly when there is talk
of building
shortages.
Up your inventories, whatever they may be.
Toilet paper, you know, tissues and all of that, Clorox. And so I do believe that after Christmas, we will see the other side of this. And we've already seen it with lumber.
So then there's an easing, you think, then?
Yes. I think a lot of prices will unwind.
So inflation is transitory?
I think it is. I know that's a dirty word now, but I think it is. And there are two other reasons I think it is. There are two very powerful secular forces. So what we just discussed was cyclical.
Right.
The two secular forces, one is good and one is bad. The good one is innovation. Innovation is inherently deflationary. And because we do the analysis using Wright's Law, we can tell you how deflationary. Just to give you a sense, artificial intelligence training costs are dropping 68% per year. Think about that. Yeah, right. We've never seen anything like that. And artificial intelligence is starting really a technology war. The companies with the biggest pools of data, the highest quality data, the best AI expertise, with the best domain expertise in the genomic space, you know, curing disease, and here's the incentive, you know, so the human being has to set the goal and the reward system. But the machine's now just training itself. And those costs are dropping 68% per year. AI is going to be a part of every industry, and that's not the only one. DNA sequencing is deflationary, robotics is deflationary, blockchain deflationary. It's taking all the middlemen out of the equation. Massive deflation, which is going to hurt companies who haven't spent enough on innovation, but have leveraged up to satisfy short-term oriented shareholders who want their profits now and their dividends
and
now.
Not thinking longer term. I have to say, this is what I remember from the first day in talking to you and just being kind of pulled into it. What do you say? You become a celebrity fund manager and maybe an unlikely celebrity, which is what everybody seems
Very
to write.
Unlikely.
I mean, how do you feel when someone says she's an unlikely celebrity? And they're tough on you, especially when the performance isn't there or it's not where it's been.
Right.
How does that feel?
You know, I've dealt with this all my career, except it's usually been inside firms. I just mentioned Odd Duck. You know, how does it feel when your own colleagues are looking at you cockeyed, like, what the heck are you doing?
Right.
So it does, I'm used to it. I actually enjoy pushback because, again, it tells me we're not in a bubble.
Right.
And, you know, as a portfolio manager, I much prefer to be climbing a wall of worry. Those are the strongest markets. And I do believe when value, when we rotate out of value, we'll come back into innovation.
So what do you say, Kathy, too, when, you know, people say you're chasing bubbles?
No, if you look at our trading, and we do publish our trades at the end of every day, we're a liquidity provider. We don't chase anything. We are not a momentum player. I was just talking about Ginkgo over there, and this is public. You know, it got slammed 2 weeks ago by Scorpion, a new short, and you know, just investigating the background of this person.
Right.
It's not the background that our three genomics analysts have. And so Ginkgo was down 50% over a few days over the short report. We were buying the heck out of it. And then today it's up, I don't know if it ended up 15 or 20%. So we are not a momentum chaser. We are a liquidity provider.
Do you often have investment hindsight at all? Do you ever look at...
We always learn from our mistakes, of course.
Like, is there something you said, man, I missed the cycle on that one?
I can tell you, this is why I'm paying so much attention to oil prices right now. So in 06, after the five financial regulators wrote a paper together, that was historic, they were usually fighting with each other for power, right?
Right.
About these exotic home equity loans, we became very concerned and pulled all the risk out of our portfolio at my former firm. And then, of course, commodity prices just took off. No, it wasn't a great call.
Oh, well, not initially, right?
Not initially. It was extremely painful.
Right.
And so part of it was oil prices just kept going up because
I think between OPEC and, you know, our banks, which fund fracking, and, you know, there were a lot of dislocations and talk about chasing on that. Well, here we have oil again doing the same thing. So I'm right. saying, okay, how long do we have to wait for the rotation back into our style? We had to wait a good 6 to 9 months then, and as the price just went crazy.
It's painful, right? And it was, every day.
Well, not for us anymore. The beauty of what we're doing now, at a firm that looked at our performance every day and frowned when it was below the benchmark, and frowned when we were, not just frowned, like asked if we were out of our minds when it was 1,000 basis points below the benchmark. That psychologically, when you have to walk into that every day and that kind of philosophy, you have to try and fight it. We have our own philosophy. 5-year investment time horizon, truth will win out. This is a bargain. This, you know, I believe, our compliance department say, I believe that that innovation stocks are on sale. So all that has happened in the last few months is the price has come down. That means if we're right on our forecast, that our rates of return have gone up.
So we've talked Tesla, we've talked a little bit. Tell me a little bit more about Bitcoin and where you see, I mean, I've never seen anything so debated. Obviously, we're seeing more legitimization as we see regulators, certainly in the US and around the world, moving forward. Today was a big day. What is the long-term play when it comes to something like cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin?
So Bitcoin specifically, we got involved when it was a $6 billion market cap. And here's Art Laffer again in my life and in ARK's life. It was a $6 billion cap then, now it's over $1 trillion, which is, but we were asking the question, this was 2015, could Bitcoin serve the three roles of money? And we came to the conclusion that it was possible. Art Laffer collaborated, he tore our original paper up, and as we were going through it, he said, this is the rules-based monetary system I've been waiting for since we left the gold exchange standard, 1971.
Right.
And I said to him, oh, how big could this be? And he said, well, how big is the US monetary base? And back then, remember, this is a $6 billion cap. Back then, it was a $4.5 trillion monetary base. Today, we're at $8.5 trillion. And Bitcoin's at $1 trillion. And that's just one of its roles, one of its roles. I think the most fascinating thing that's happening is in El Salvador. Have you heard? They deemed Bitcoin, the president, who right. tweets every day, deemed Bitcoin legal tender.
And it was a Bloomberg quiz question.
Okay.
We do it every week.
Anyway. Okay. And sent a Chivo wallet to everyone in the population eligible, so 4 million. 3 million, it had $30 worth of Bitcoin in it. 3 million have downloaded it. Only 1.2 million in that country have a banking relationship. So this is the new bank, digital wallets. And it's going to be true in this country. It's going to be true around the world.
So all in.
All in.
China,
yes.
You've been in, you've been out. And sometimes we're trying to understand.
Yes, yes.
So how are we supposed to look at China right now? And the clampdowns that we've seen in the government, certainly on different sectors
yes.
that have just decimated those sectors in terms of the value of them.
Yes.
So what do you expect kind of to be your involvement
yes.
in investment play?
Our first move away from China was when China was had a very strong move, and what you know the innovation there was being deeply appreciated while
right.
ours was not. So that was that kind of move. The second time we moved in, then we moved in, why? We saw the reaction to COVID and we got more interested because it was the most disciplined country in terms of both monetary and fiscal policy during the crisis. And I thought that China had the possibility of becoming the Germany and Switzerland of the world, you know, in terms of discipline, monetary, fiscal. As soon as Jack Ma was banished, effectively,
right.
last November, we started pulling back. Because what we're doing, and especially during February through May, where our strategy, just to give you a sense how volatile that is, our strategy from mid-February through mid-May. Most people wouldn't admit this, maybe, but this is how volatile we are.
Yeah.
Transparency was down 37%, peak to trough. So we have come back, but during that period, what we do, as we always do, we concentrated our portfolio towards our highest conviction names. China was moving away because almost every week and month there was a new regulatory move,
right,
or crackdown. And so it was easy to do that. It was great because I'm always scrambling, looking for cash during a correction. Okay, where's the confidence lower? Where, you know, let's buy into some of these, our favorites,
right,
here. Now, common prosperity. So what have we done? No China in our flagship. We do own some China in a few of our portfolios, the ones focused on autonomous technology and robotics. But we're very particular, very low margin companies, because margin is clearly not appreciated by the government anymore, common prosperity.
Right.
And very beneficial to tier three, tier four cities, common prosperity. So JD Logistics, JD.com, Pinduoduo.
Does it stay this way, do you think, in China for a while?
Well,
I mean, it's hard to say,
yes,
but China is certainly a country when they make a decision, it's longer term. It's longer term planning.
Right.
And President Xi certainly seems to be on this mission.
And I think he is very unsettled that the three-child policy is not working.
Yeah.
And so there is a big social engineering. And by the way, this was all very forecastable, right? I mean, demographics, they knew 50 years ago what was going to happen.
Right.
So I think that's part of it. And, you know, there are the haves and the have-nots in China, like there are, like there is around the world. I think China's taking it more seriously because there's probably more social unrest than we now appreciate. What I don't understand is they're going after real estate, which is 75% of the consumer savings in China.
Individuals now, in China.
And if yes, individual saving. If the prices are going down, which they have been, I think that could really hurt consumer confidence. I think it already is. And then last weekend, or the weekend before, the government, the national government, went after the regulators who had focused on the financial industry, as well as the financial institutions. And I'm just saying, wow, they're playing with fire.
It's a moving, yeah.
And talk about a cyclical risk out there. Think about that if we lose China. At the margin, China has been responsible for a tremendous amount of cyclical growth.
Right.
And exactly. Commodity price inflation.
Did an M&A panel here, and you know, one of the risks that they, one of the bankers brought up is that China specifically, geopolitical even though, in terms of military tension. So everybody's watching. So the future.
Yeah.
It's in Florida.
Oh, yes.
How come?
most people would tell you there are tax considerations and so forth.
Is that
of course
it?
That's part of it, of course. However, we were looking for a city that might be able to evolve into something like Austin has. And
do you think it can
yes,
be Austin?
Yes, I absolutely
Why?
Do. If you have not been to St. Pete, you must go. I've now become St. Pete's official ambassador. So
who's been to St. Pete?
St. Pete?
All right, fair amount.
How it is, I mean, all my life I've said, I will never live in Florida. And here I am. I went to St. Pete. It is a young, vibrant town focused on culture, arts, music, a lot of tourism, very clean, very lovely,
yeah,
very friendly people from all over the place. And I do think we could have something like a South by Southwest in the St. Pete, Tampa region. I think Tampa's very exciting as well. Jeff Vinnick and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have really brought Tampa alive.
Do you keep your analysts in New York, at home?
Where they want to be. Those who are interested in pursuing a portfolio management track will have to be in St. Pete. But we have a hybrid working style. Our director of research has always worked in LA. We have other analysts in California, Chicago. So it's worked for us. It's worked for us. But as I said before, we were together, and I think going through this downturn in the market, probably being together would have been better, but it made us work harder at overcoming the lack of closeness.
One of the things I do love talking about you is just kind of where your mind is going and investments. And you do look for innovative, disruptive companies, but you've been buying something like a Pfizer. I don't think of Pfizer.
Yes.
The old big pharma.
Yeah.
With the infrastructure and the legacy of it. But it is a company that you found interesting.
So we are, we think, one of the most interesting opportunities out there that is in the value space. Is biotech and maybe some pharma. Those companies that we see embracing the convergence between and among DNA sequencing, artificial intelligence, and CRISPR gene editing, gene therapies generally, we're very interested in, because the returns on their R&D investment in the last 20 years have dropped, this is on average for the industry, from 20% to 7%. We believe, with especially artificial intelligence, trial failures will reduce. There will be a reduction by at least 25%. Could be a lot more. The time to market could be 25% less. And so we could go back to the golden age. Now, not every company is embracing these, but those who are, and Pfizer, with some of its moves into base editing, is intriguing us here, as is Regeneron and Vertex.
So what's the moonshot we should be thinking about? I did an interesting panel here about longevity and technology and just talking about different types of technologies that are out there. What is the Tesla of tomorrow? What is the Apple of tomorrow? I mean, obviously we don't know, but what is it in terms of the general technologies? You guys do the research that we should be thinking about.
Well, I do think the genomic space, because of how our industry is set up, where you have healthcare analysts who historically have not liked technology, and technology analysts who historically have not liked to get involved with healthcare, too regulated, too slow, we've got this major convergence taking place, and I don't think the traditional asset management world, from a research point of view, is set up correctly to capitalize on it. We have set up our team by technologies, and we have three genome analysts, so we've got them very specialized on the technologies, and they are looking at how these technologies are going to cut across sectors. The GDP, the cost savings and the GDP creation out of healthcare, we think is going to be phenomenal.
And it does feel like one space that's been very stagnant.
It does. And there's one other thing. I'll just throw out a number. It's fresh and it's subject to revision. But we were assuming that in the next 10 years, artificial intelligence would deliver in the enterprise software space. Would deliver a market cap opportunity of $30 trillion, okay? From tens of billions today. Our new number is 80 trillion, and from tens of billions today. So we think that is the big new frontier, but it's going to be in transportation, autonomous taxi technology, autonomous trucks, drones, and so forth. It is in genomics, and so it's going to make these platforms come alive and evolve much faster than even we thought was possible.
Right.
I mean, this 30 trillion was a 2 year ago number. Now
Which
we're
is up amazing. To that's double.
Now we're almost tripled.
Tripled. So, last question: unlikely celebrity fund manager. What do you make of the copycats? Because it just seems like every day on Bloomberg, there are your traditional Wall Street firms and your index fund managers, you know who they are, and they've got an innovative, disruptive strategy. So does that give you vindication, or do you say, I don't really want the competition, or
no.
Great, because it just means more innovation?
Well, I don't know how, we definitely welcome the competition because, again, I still think there's a massive misallocation of capital to the past. And the more to the future, the more the U.S. keeps its competitive advantage and the world solves problems, right? And the world becomes a better place. If they have not set up, reorganized their research departments in the way I just described, then I don't think they're really competing with us. the way we're doing it.
Because you do it differently.
We do. We do it differently. And there are more ways to do this than just the way we're doing it. But I think the depth to which our analysts go into these technologies has never been done on Wall Street before. And that's, again, because we set up the firm to do that.
So disruption.
Disruption.
Going to leave it on that note.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.